How proportionate or disproportionate will Israel's response be? After a string of setbacks and humiliation that include the killing of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon, Iran Tuesday firing its long-range missiles directly at Israel. As Benjamin Netanyahu and his generals ponder their next move, there are obvious targets and huge unknowns. First, the pager attacks of 2 weeks ago on Hezbollah command became a bombing campaign that triggered mass displacement of Lebanese civilians. Then, signs of growing incursions in Lebanon, Israel losing 8 soldiers this Wednesday. And now, direct confrontation on a whole new scale between Israel and Iran. Since October 7th of last year, U.S. diplomacy has been in overdrive to prevent an out-of-control regional war. Can an aging lame duck president be heard above the din of blaming and brinkmanship? If not, well, then who then? Today in the France 24 debate, what response from Israel? And joining us from London, Aaron Bregman, senior teaching fellow at the War Studies Department of King's College London. Thank you for being with us. In Washington, we're with Barbara Slavin, director of the Stimson Center think tank's Middle East Perspectives Project. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
He's an American in Paris for a couple of days. Benam Ben Taliblou, research fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies think tank. Thanks for stopping in.
Thank you.
And France 24 International Affairs editor Ketevan Gorgiastani. How are you?
Good.
Good. That's good to know. Your reactions, by the way, on the hashtag F24Debate. Back in April, Iran gave plenty of warning through back channels and proxies before launching missiles at Israel. This time was different. Oliver Farrey has more.
The skies over Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities lit up by a hail of missiles, about 200 in total, launched by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Almost all were intercepted. 6 sites were targeted, including 3 air bases and Mossad's headquarters in the outskirts of Tel Aviv. 2 people in Israel were reported injured, while a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank was killed by falling debris. Tehran said it was in response to Israel's assassination of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah and warned more was to come.
If the Zionist regime, which has gone insane, is not contained by America and Europe and intends to continue such crimes or do anything against our sovereignty or territorial integrity, tonight's operation will be repeated with much higher magnitude and we will hit all their infrastructure.
But Benjamin Netanyahu was equally bullish and promised a crushing response.
Iran made a big mistake tonight, and it will pay for it. The regime in Iran does not understand our determination to defend ourselves and our determination to retaliate against our enemies.
Washington also gave its full support, with Joe Biden saying his administration was in close contact with Israel on deciding on what action to take. It's the second time this year that Iran has attacked Israel. A previous salvo of drone and missiles in April was largely repelled by Israel's Iron Dome defense system.
First off, let's begin by talking about what happened Tuesday. Benam Ben Taliblou, one killed, a Palestinian citizen who was killed by falling debris. There were more killed in the Tel Aviv terror attack on Tuesday, where 2 Palestinian militants gunned down 7 bystanders at a tramway stop. Was this a proportionate attack by Iran? Was it the most or the least they could do since they'd had such a bad run in the previous weeks?
It's a great question. And I mean, proportionate is not really the word of the day here, nor is it the word that defines the Israel-Iran shadow war, nor is it the one that defines how this shadow war has crept out into the open, both in April and in now. The way I assess this attack compared to April is that it's a measure of volume. You have a lot of similar themes, but really increased. If you look at the April attack, there was about a 10 to 12 day kind of public international campaign that was really the telegraphing of the strike. This time that was diminished, moved down to a 4 to a 2 hour window before the launch. Last go around, you had ballistic missiles with lower and slower flying cruise missiles and drones. This time you had double the ballistic missiles and no cruise missiles and drones. Last time you had largely but not exclusively older variants of Iran's first generation liquid propellant ballistic missiles. This time newer and more efficient and more militarily reliable solid propellant ballistic missiles.
But Benham, you look at the casualty toll and you ask, is it just a shot across the bow?
No, it's first and foremost, it's a success for something that the Israelis and the Americans have been investing in significantly since the end of the Cold War, and that's homeland layered air and missile defense. It's also a success for a lot of the quiet, thankless work lots of Pentagon officials across three very different administrations have tried to do in the region to build a more integrated air and missile defense architecture that tracks, detects, and destroys these projectiles. Then, of course, there's the shortcomings on the Iranian side, both technical and political. And then, lest we forget, I think the Iranians understand that they're conventionally outgunned here. So as much as they hit the gas, there was a way that they also came in and hit the brakes. This time, however, they hit the brakes much less than in April.
Less than in April, but they still hit them a little bit. Aaron Bregman, you are with us from London, from King's College. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate. What do you make of what happened Tuesday evening?
Well, the Iranians inflicted such a big barrage on Israel. They caused damage. They did cause damage to air bases. They attacked military targets, but I think that they understood that the military targets are close to populated areas, and they understood that it could land on civilians in Israel. They tried, for example, to land a few ballistic missiles on the Mossad headquarters just north of Tel Aviv, and that's why we saw missiles landing on north Tel Aviv. So I think that from the Iranian point of view, it was quite successful. And from an Israeli point of view, it was also quite successful in blocking it.
So, one all, Barbara Slavin, is that your view?
That's a very optimistic view of things. I'm afraid we have to wait and see what the Israeli response will be, and then what the Iranian response will be, before we can come to this this conclusion. I know we'll get to it a little bit later, but I see that Joe Biden has just said that Israel should not hit Iran's nuclear facilities in retaliation, which is something that a lot of hawks have been urging now for a long time. So I hope that that will not be the method of response. There's also some talk about using more economic sanctions, although I'm racking my brain to figure out exactly what is left to sanction in Iran. And I don't think that would satisfy the Israelis.
Well, we've already had one response, a verbal response, and that is from the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who was due to speak with Joe Biden this Wednesday to coordinate, and who issued a pointed threat to Iran after Tuesday's attacks. Let's listen.
Iran made a big mistake tonight, and it will pay for it. The regime in Iran doesn't understand our determination to defend ourselves and our determination to retaliate against our enemies. Sinwar and Deif didn't understand it. Nasrallah or Mohsen didn't understand it. Apparently, those in Tehran don't understand this either. They will understand. We will keep to the rules we have determined. Whoever attacks us, we attack them.
There are those in Tehran who do not understand. Barbara Slavin, is that a personal threat against the supreme leader?
Certainly sounds like it, doesn't it? He has, of course, been moved to an undisclosed location, although supposedly he is going to lead Friday prayers in Tehran this week, which would put him in a position, frankly, of extreme vulnerability. Yeah, it sounds like a threat against high-level officials in Iran, but the Israelis have already killed a number of high-level members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Again, this may be partly bluster on Bibi Netanyahu's part, and I hope that there are adult voices in the room that will restrain Israel to keep this from continuing this hideous escalation.
Aaron Bregman, what are the targets? Is it a pinpoint attack against a person like it was against that attack on Hassan, that assassination of Hassan Nasrallah at the inauguration of Iran's new president back on July 31st? Is it on nuclear sites? Is it on oil installations?
Well, let me start by saying that the Israelis are going to hit back. That's clear. But I was very surprised this morning when I opened my eyes and I realized that the Israeli airplanes are still parked. I was expecting them to be either on the way to Iran or on the way back, but they were still in Israel. And I'm saying it because the Israeli tactic, what they usually do is to hit immediately. They don't wait for too long. So now they're waiting. And I can have two explanations to that. It could be just tactic, maybe waiting for an intelligent piece. Maybe they want to bomb something and also to assassinate someone, and they are waiting for this someone to move into the building. So it could be tactic or tactical. The other explanation why the Israelis are still not on the way is hesitation. It might be that they hesitate. Maybe because there is an enormous pressure on them, American pressure, French pressure, not to overdo it. And maybe they understand or they think that it's not a good idea to attack Iran and to open a new front when the Gaza front is an unfinished business and they've just started with Lebanon. Now, very shortly about the potential targets. They could, of course, bomb the oil refineries in Iran. It will be very visible. Everyone will be impressed, and it will have a strong impact on the Iranian economy and world economy too. Another potential target, everyone is talking about it, is the nuclear facilities in Iran, but Israel cannot destroy all of it on its own. It can cause big damage to it and delay the production in these facilities, but it cannot do it on its own.
Can't do it on its own. And Barbara Slavin teased it for us earlier, the U.S. president on that score, speaking at Andrews Air Force Base just outside of Washington earlier.
An attack on Iran's nuclear sites by Israel.
Yes,
sir. Biden saying he wouldn't support a strike on Iran's nuclear sites. Kedavan Gorgestani.
Yes, and the U.S. president going after that comment, saying that there would be some new sanction. And to the point that Barbara was making, it's very unclear what that sort of sanctions response would be, but I guess they spoke about it in the G7 call with other leaders. But to go back to some of the thinking within the Israeli government for that response, there's some good reporting by Barak Ravid for Axios, who says that the Israeli government is considering a significant retaliation within days and mentioning the oil refineries as possible targets, the targeted assassinations as a possibility, or other strategic locations in Iran. There was no mention of the nuclear sites. Clearly, the Americans are not going for it. And that is important because as much as we've been talking about the fact that the Americans have so far at least publicly not really succeeded in sort of holding back the Israelis, if Israel responds massively, the Iranians have said, we will retaliate too. We will go tit for tat. And if Iran retaliates again, the Israelis will need the Americans to help them defend themselves. They will need cooperation with CENTCOM in the region. They will need more support for that defense. So they can't go completely against what the Americans are telling them in this case.
Aaron Bregman pointing it out, Israel didn't need the United States to kill Hassan Nasrallah. but it would need the United States to go after those nuclear sites. Do you agree with Joe Biden?
Listen, I think whether or not I agree with Joe Biden on the sanctions front, it would be too little too late. If oil sanctions and meaningful economic measures were really on the table from this administration, they should have been implementing the laws that were already on the books in January 2021 when the Biden administration entered office. And much of the nuclear knowledge base gains that the Islamic Republic has made has actually occurred while those sanctions were not lifted but were not being enforced. So that's one point of disagreement. On the difference between a counterproliferation operation and a deterrence by punishment operation, if the Israelis are going to go and respond to the recent missile attack, that's one thing. But there is a reason why neither America nor Israel has directly done this counterproliferation operation when Iran did not even have some of these missiles and some of these drones, and when the nuclear sites were more contained and when there was less fissile material in country, is that it is a harder target. It is not an operation. It has to be part of a larger military campaign. And for an administration that has pulled punches, even with respect to Iran-backed proxies in the region, which are conventionally much weaker, and the response ratio is much more lopsided, I find it highly dubious that as you get closer to an election, they would be willing to roll the dice in such a risky and escalatory fashion, even though they may believe and continue to say Israel has the right to defend itself. I mean, there's the question within Israel as well. You had the former prime minister come out and talk about, you know, potentially going after the nuclear program. But I think you're largely the most important variable. And if we're going to compare Israel's April response to the potential response here, the most important variable to look for is publicity and ownership. I think if the Israelis...
Yeah, just to remind our viewers, back in April, this was it all started when Israel hit
April
parts
1st.
Of the consulate in Damascus, the Iranian consulate. Iranians responding, and the Israelis hitting an Air Force base near Isfahan, near one of the nuclear sites, but not the nuclear site itself.
That's right. They hit a radar that was covering an air base, a military facility, and a major nuclear storage center in Isfahan. This is one of three parts of a major Russian-provided air defense system, the S-300, that Iran purchased many years ago from Russia and received in 2015, 2016. But what the Israelis showed in April was that they could achieve militarily much more using militarily much less. But they did not take credit for the operation in the hopes of dampening an Iranian response. Now I think that the tables have turned. Israel wants to be seen as responding. So the most important variable is publicity. And because it shows a willingness to escalate and a willingness to run the gambit much more than a tit for tat.
Aaron Brigman, there's the calculus of a prime minister who's always got his eye on having a majority in the Knesset, and there's the calculus of his generals. What do the generals want? What does Benjamin Netanyahu want?
I think that they both think that it is important to respond, to hit back. I believe that, and I disagree with the gentleman, I think the view in Israel is that they should somehow hit back, but not expand and not escalate on the Iranian front. They do not want the Israelis, at least this is what they say, they do not want a regional war. They want to concentrate on Lebanon, where it's going to be bloody and messy in the coming weeks. One comment about the sanctions offered by Biden. I think that the sanctions are meant to offer Netanyahu something that he could go out and say, oh, I don't have to bomb the nuclear facilities or the Iranian oil refineries. I can do something relatively small, something between the two, and I also have the sanctions. This is my explanation to the sanctions offered by Biden, because for him to have a regional war before the November election is a nightmare. So therefore, I think that both Americans and the Israelis are not interested in a regional war, and overdoing it might lead to a regional war.
Well, let's talk about that potential for a regional war in a moment. But first, we can't omit the fact that in Tehran, we saw the Supreme Leader this Wednesday. He made no mention of his country firing missiles at Israel when he addressed students in the Iranian capital. besides stating that the death of Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah was, quote, not a small matter. Ayatollah Khamenei speaking more in sort of broader terms.
The root of the problem which causes these conflicts, wars, tensions, is the presence of the same people who claim that they want peace and tranquility in the region. I'm referring to the U.S. and to some European countries.
Barbara Slavin, in that clip, is Ayatollah Khamenei saying nothing, or is he saying something?
It's interesting. You know, this coincides with a new agreement reached between the United States and Iraq that will have American forces there reduced and also moved out of Baghdad, moved out of the Assad base also, and north to Erbil in the Kurdish area. So in a way, Ayatollah Khamenei is achieving one of his goals, which is to reduce the U.S. footprint in the region. On the other hand, this entire crisis has led to the United States repeatedly sending more troops to the Middle East, aircraft carriers, all manner of equipment to help the Israelis defeat Iran and its other enemies. So it's kind of a mixed picture. We should also mention this comes at a time when Iran, you know, has just had these presidential elections, a new president who came to the United Nations. I was there last week and met this guy, Pezeshkian, who's talking about reaching out to the West. I believe Pezeshkian met President Macron and other senior European officials while he was there. So the timing of this is terrible from the point of view of Iran, which wants to see relief of economic sanctions and wants to see some economic rebound.
So, Barbara, you believe that when the new president is talking about reopening nuclear discussions, it's genuinely because sanctions are hitting hard, or is it just a stalling tactic at a time when militarily Iran's proxies are reeling?
I think it's to get real economic relief. You know, after Nasrallah was assassinated by the Israelis, the Iranian currency, the rial, went up over 600,000 to the dollar. When I started going to Iran in the 1990s, it was 10,000 rials to the dollar. So you can imagine what this does to the Iranian economy and purchasing power and inflation. Now, they have serious problems, not to mention the divisions between society and the regime over issues like the enforced veiling of women and so on. So the timing is terrible for Iran. I think... And here I agree with your guest from King's College that they would like to somehow prevent this from becoming a regional war. The question is whether there is enough diplomatic skill in the world to manage this. And we haven't seen it so far. I mean, it's a year and still no ceasefire in Gaza.
Still no ceasefire in Gaza. And we saw some pointed language earlier at the United Nations Security Council. From the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. against Iran. And this follows comments that were made on Tuesday. Joe Biden and his vice president putting aside their criticism of the masks of civilian casualties inflicted by Israel on Gaza. A direct confrontation with Iran, that's a different ballgame.
Make no mistake. The United States is fully, fully, fully supportive of Israel.
And we heard the same language from Kamala Harris during that meeting on Tuesday. So two messages. One, we stand against Iran, but on the other hand, telling Israel not to go hit the nuclear sites.
Well, yes, because the Americans, and this is really a bipartisan question, if you put aside the real left wing of the Democratic Party, this message of we will stand with Israel and its right to defend itself is unwavering. We've seen Joe Biden repeating this over and over again. What is interesting is that in his comments right before he was getting on Air Force One, he also said they have a right to respond, but something along the lines of it has to be measured. So there is still this willingness and diplomatic attempts to at least, they understand that Israel has to respond, but to at least try to contain and minimize that response. And they did that successfully, if you will, back in April, because at some point there were talks about the Israelis wanting to hit back much harder than they actually did. And in part, it was the diplomatic skills of the Americans, whether it was Joe Biden or others in the administration, to tell the Israelis, remember what the quote was take the win. You hit and now keep it down. Don't make it even worse. The question is, will that work this time? Will the Americans have the same sway over the Israelis? And do the Israelis want to follow? Maybe on the nuclear part, they will likely listen to the Americans. For the rest, it's hard to tell.
Listening to Ketev, I'm haunted by Aaron Brigman's remark earlier that he was expecting when he woke up this morning to hear the announcement that Israeli jets had already been to Iran. Why do you think they haven't been yet?
Well, I mean, the Occam's razor is that they're planning, that this is a fundamentally different kind of operation. If the modus operandi is going to be what we've seen from the Israelis in the past 2-3 weeks, which is a very significant, bold escalation that delivers something lethal and politically impactful that changes the situation, you don't do that in the blink of an eye, and particularly not for a country that you've had this kind of indirect shadow war with for about 4 decades. So I think planning defines one. Two is, of course, politics within Israel as well as politics within the United States of America. How Israel manages its relationship with America and how America manages its relationship with Israel. Despite political tensions, the desire to keep that bridge matters. Remember, based on reporting from the April attack and the Israeli response on April 19th, Netanyahu allegedly reportedly settled for the least option, the lowest option that he was presented among from a menu of his generals. We wonder what that menu looks like today. Is it sites? Is it personnel? Is it in Iran? Is it out of Iran? I, for one, again, for the purposes of deterrence, stress that the key factor here is publicity. Will they own the strike? Will they do a press conference afterward? That is a sign of how much more they have left in the tank to continue if it's a tit for tat. And just historically, when you look at Israeli deterrence, the willingness to retain the relationship with America 90% of the time, and that 10% when they buck the relationship, that's the time when they get the deterrent dividends, because the issue they escalate over is deemed as being existential, and they hope the adversary receives that same message.
And is the killing of Hassan Nasrallah in that 10% that you describe? After all, I think they warned the Americans.
Very briefly, I think they warned. But also, the fact that the person that they had targeted on April 1st in Damascus, they killed his replacement, is an IRGC brigadier general who was in Mr. Niloufarouchan, I believe his name is. He's sanctioned by a few countries, I believe Australia, if I'm not mistaken, but definitely the UK and the EU and, sorry, the EU and the US. And he was in there as well. So the Islamic Republic waited after Haniyeh, waited after Nasrallah, and now 3-for-1 with respect to the killing of Mr. Niloufarouchan.
All right, and we heard Joe Biden's tough talk, Kamala Harris echoing what he said on Tuesday. Donald Trump also weighing in, the Republican nominee, telling a rally in Wisconsin, what if he'd been reelected in 2020?
This would have never happened. We did the Abraham Accords. I think everybody, including Iran, would have been in the Abraham Accords had I taken over as president. I think even Iran would have been in the Abraham Accords. Ultimately, it would have been great for everybody, and you would have had peace in the Middle East.
Would have had peace in the Middle East. Benam Bentaleblou, is this the same Donald Trump who had, you know, Mike Pompeo as his Secretary of State and was very hawkish when it came to Iran? Here he's saying, we could make peace with Iran.
It is.
Can you explain this quote, this clip?
Well, I can attempt to. I think it's the same Donald Trump that you had from the campaign period 2015, 2016, where he distinguished himself from many of his other Republican competitors, running mates, when the vast majority of them said that they would rip up the JCPOA nuclear deal on day one. And his strategy, and I believe his line at the time, was, I buy bad deals, I make them good deals. He didn't rush for the exits of that deal. He spent about 6 months trying to develop an independent Iran policy. First, he certified the deal. then removed the waivers, then left the deal in two different phases, then took about 6 more months to get rid of the oil penalties, and then finally designated the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So for someone who talked about max pressure, he's done a whole host of different things where maybe 2-3 weeks before he's talked about standing with the Iranian people.
Here, come on, here he's talking about we could have made Iran part of the Abraham Accords.
That is next to impossible, not because of Donald Trump's efforts, but because of the veto that Ali Khamenei...
But is that what he really wants?
I'm sure... Well, I think many U.S. presidents have tried to bring the Islamic Republic in from the cold. I think the problem is the government of the Islamic Republic. I think many administrations would like to have ties, not just between Israel and Saudi Arabia, but Iran, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. The challenge is, of course, that the Islamic Republic says death to Israel means it, puts national resources towards it, and that's why an Islamic Republic in the Abraham Accords is essentially impossible, and that's why opposition activists talk about something entirely different, which is the Cyrus Accords and people-to-people, Iranians to Israelis.
Barbara Slavin, of course, Donald Trump at that rally in Wisconsin could have chosen the opposite tack. He could have said, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are not tough enough when it comes to Iran. Why did he choose this tack?
He's anybody who pretends to understand Donald Trump, you know, God bless them. He also threatened just a couple of days earlier to wipe Iran off the map if it dared to carry out assassination plots against him. So, you know, I would put no stock in it. I agree with Ben that Iran in the Abraham Accords is ridiculous. I mean, the whole reason Hamas attacked Israel when it did was to prevent Saudi Arabia from joining the Abraham Accords. The only possibility is that at some point Iran realizes that Israel is not going anywhere, that the axis of resistance is not going to fulfill its objectives, and recognizes Israel's right to exist along with a Palestinian state. I mean, that is something that I think might be plausible if Israel has a different government and if the Palestinians could get their act together. But for that, we need a ceasefire. We need massive diplomacy.
Massive diplomacy, which is tough to do when you're a little more than 1 month out from elections in the United States. Now, we've spent most of this discussion talking about that direct confrontation between Israel and Iran. There is the question of whether or not it's escalating all around. The New York Times, quoting U.S. and Israeli intelligence sources, is claiming that Israel's already destroyed half of Iran's proxy militia Hezbollah's weapons stockpile, all the while admitting the group has a tunnel infrastructure that is impossible to destroy absent a long-term presence in the country, which Israeli officials say they are, quote, reluctant to reoccupy. On a day that's seen 8 Israeli soldiers killed, that was fighting that was taking place inside of southern Lebanon. Eliza Herbert has more.
In 1 hour alone, 40 projectiles crossed the Lebanese border into northern Israel on Wednesday, according to Israel's Defense Force. Here, footage shows one being shot down by Israel's air defense system. While there were no reports of casualties, the barrage is a sign from Hezbollah that though it may be weakened, it is not giving up. Over the border in southern Lebanon, the militant group claimed to have inflicted losses and forced Israeli troops to retreat in the village of Al-Edessa, then again in the village of Marun al-Ras. According to Hezbollah's media officer, this is only the first round, and the group has enough fighters, weapons and ammunition to push back Israel. Shortly afterwards, the Lebanese army posted this on social media.
An Israeli enemy force breached the Blue Line, approximately 400 metres into Lebanese territory in the areas of Kherbet Yarun and Bab al-Edessa, then withdrew after a short period.
Meanwhile, the IDF released this footage it says shows troops on the ground in southern Lebanon, where it claimed to have destroyed, quote, over 150 terror infrastructures. Since Monday, the IDF has ordered 27 villages to evacuate as part of its, quote, limited operation into the country. It is the first time Israeli troops have invaded Lebanon since the 2006 war. Unlike Gaza, which is mostly flat coastal plains, southern Lebanon is made up of hills and mountainous terrain, making it difficult for tanks to move uninhibited.
Aaron Bregman, our correspondent in Jerusalem, was making the calculation that Israel has lost some 700 soldiers since the beginning, since October the 7th, half of those on day one, and that was at the border, obviously, with Gaza. With a campaign in Lebanon, and today was the first day you had fatalities, 8 soldiers killed. Is Israeli public opinion ready for this, for a stepped-up casualty toll?
The Israeli memory is very short. I was in the I fought in the Lebanon War in 1982, and everyone was very enthusiastic about going into Lebanon and, you know, getting rid of Yasser Arafat and all the rest. But then the casualties, it was awful, especially in southern Lebanon between Israel and Hezbollah. Between 1985 and 2000, Israel lost 870 troops in south Lebanon. And therefore, if they go into Lebanon, and if they get stuck there again, it will be very bloody and very messy.
Are they conscious of it? You're saying they have a short memory. They still have a short memory today? Is this a moment of hubris after what's been militarily a good 2 weeks for Israel?
A little bit, yeah. If you watch Israeli television, Israeli news, as I do, there is hubris there. They are very, very, there is a euphoria there. They think that it's going very well. The problem in Lebanon is that you think that it's going to be short, a few weeks, but then you get sucked into the area, and then it becomes not days but weeks, and then months, and then years. You know, when we went to Lebanon in 1982, the Operation Peace for Galilee, which became the first Lebanon war, was supposed to be up to 72 hours. This was the idea. It took Israel 18 years to get out of Lebanon. And if they are not careful now, history is going to repeat itself.
And here's a mystery. I'll put it to you first, Aaron. Why is it that we've been talking so much about Hezbollah having stepped up capacities, particularly medium to long range missiles, and they've barely touched them?
Well, they do. You know, they do fire into Israel. The media focuses mainly on Israel because Israel is so successful in the last couple of weeks, including the James Bond operation in Beirut, etc. But Hezbollah, they do fire back into Israel since the morning, not as much as was expected, because we experts and Israelis predicted that there will be hundreds and thousands of missiles a day. This is not happening, because about 50% of it was destroyed by from the air. And it is very difficult for Hezbollah to fire the rockets because, number one, communication is not very good. The Israelis destroy their communication system. And then the Israelis are just above them all the time, full control of the sky. And it is very difficult to take out the rockets. Some of them are in tunnels and fire. So, but they do fire into Israel.
Benham Ben Talablu, you heard there, Abram, talking about air superiority, huge intelligence superiority. We've seen that over the last 2 weeks. And yet he says this could be a moment of hubris for Israel.
Well, those military variables do indeed exist, and they partially help to define why Hezbollah has been fighting this war as it has since October 8th. Lest we forget, Iran has a theory of victory. On October 7th and in the run-up to October 7th, Iran supported Hamas for that terrorist attack. When it saw an Israeli military response was essentially coming, on October 8th, Hezbollah entered. On October 17th, the Shia militias in Iraq and Syria entered. And on October 19th, the Houthis entered. And by rearranging this cocktail, shaking it a different level of firepower from a different group at a different time from a different geography, Iran is trying to bail out Hamas on the cheap. So it's trying to invalidate exactly the variables that the professor just mentioned, which is the ground superiority, the air superiority, the greater military capacity. It's trying to invalidate that through a sustained war of attrition. Now, here's an interesting fact, and forgive me for the seminar. Hezbollah has only fired one ballistic missile in its history at Israel. Everything else is actually a rocket.
So is what? Is it that they don't exist?
Or no,
is
they exist. No, they exist. But a ballistic missile is a high and fast flying missile. It's a weapon of war. Even projectiles that are under 1,000 kilometers are technically militarily classified as short-range ballistic missiles. The ballistic missiles that Iran has helped Hezbollah produce indigenously since 2014 at max have a range of 300 kilometers with about a 200-250 kilogram warhead. These are projectiles that only once Hezbollah has fired, because they understand that that would be the beginning of an escalation slope that the Israelis would immediately be able to dominate. And that's why I think you've seen Hezbollah widen the war slowly, make it a war of attrition against the will of Israel rather than against the capability of Israel to stay in the fight, because they can't win the capabilities war. And the way the war has widened since October 8th is threefold. One, different targets. Two, different geography. Three, different weapons. And that final cherry on the sundae was just that one ballistic missile. And if the New York Times reporting is true, that says based on Israeli and American sources, half of this arsenal is already gone, then the lion's share of the threat is already gone as well. Because if you have the most destabilizing weapons gone, the people in the middle level doing the command and control and having to launch these things gone, the way you launch a ballistic missile is drastically different than the way you launch a 107-millimeter rocket. You need more infrastructure. Depending on the guidance, you need a crew on the ground. Depending on the fuel type, you have to fuel it in advance. Once it's fueled, you can't move it. Depends on the capabilities they have. And if Israel was successful in going after operatives, going after command and control, and now nullifying part of the arsenal, well, then the non-response is simply defined as defeat and an understanding that they can't win an escalation spiral with a country like Israel that has a conventional superiority that is far greater.
Barbara Slavin, what about in the other direction? Because we've seen in the last days Israel strike at targets inside Yemen. Again, these are Iran allies slash proxies, the Houthis in that particular case. Inside Syria, there was again a strike this Wednesday against in Damascus. Can Israel fire on all cylinders right now?
Well, obviously Israel can do that as long as the United States continues to provide the support that it's provided in terms of ammunition and spare parts and intelligence and logistical support that the U.S. has provided. So, yeah, they can continue for quite some time. They do have this kind of dominance. But I agree with Professor Bregman that the Lebanon war, I think that that's a big mistake. The ground invasion is a big mistake. They will get sucked in. They're still in Gaza. The Israeli hostages are not home. Who knows how many are still alive? So at some point, this has to come to a diplomatic end. It cannot continue indefinitely. We should also mention that Israel's economy is really hurting. Their credit rating has been downgraded twice. I don't think there are too many tourists going there these days. A lot of professionals have left the country. Many were upset with Bibi Netanyahu anyway because of his dictatorial tendencies domestically. And now, they've had a terrible scare. Even if Israel and the United States and Britain and others were able to defeat the Iranian attack, still people were cowering in basements and bomb shelters for quite some time yesterday. And I'm sure that's not an experience that people want to repeat.
Very briefly, Aaron Bregman, because we're out of time. Where does the tipping point come from? Not forward, towards escalation. We've talked about that the whole hour, but towards de-escalation.
I think that we are not going to see de-escalation in the coming weeks. I think that it is only escalation. I believe, or I hope, I might be wrong, that between Israel and Iran, it will be a few blows and things might calm down. I think that the center of gravity is moving to Lebanon, where we will see a sheer escalation when Israeli troops are going into Lebanon, into South Lebanon. There are already two divisions there. That's an enormous force. It's a big force. So there is a gap between the talk, Biden and Netanyahu, about a small operation and what we can see on the ground, which is preparations for quite a big invasion.
Aaron Bregman, many thanks for being with us from London. Barbara Slavin in Washington. Ben Taliblu, Kedavan Gorgiastani, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.